what you don't understand. You got the pizza play on speed dial. A large hoagie always makes you smile. Your big gun boats always get so sore when you start clapping them on the dance floor. We'll find something so your belly won't show. You passed Cusky a long time ago. Do the big guy's song. Do the big guy's song. We'll do the big guy's song. Do the big guy's song. You can't dance to save your ass. Can't fit in the ballet class. You take out the floor. Wipe out the floor. They throw you out, and you can't come back no more, and you can't come back no more.
Now everything's cool, that's a part of the band. And my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what it did.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll get on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
Terrible Tommy here in the bunker, right here in the bunker, and that was from East Germany. Now, what do they call it out there? What does our boy call it? I forget now. But anyhow, that was the Big Guy Stomp, dedicated to all the obese, overweight people out there that can't dance. I have seen some people who were overweight that could dance, but not too many. Well, this damn thing might work a little better if I had the microphone in front of me instead of 3 feet away. How about that? Yeah. Like I say, there is our Halloween music, our dedication. That's a request. And if you don't like our request, well, you better get your own request in. But don't get too far off the track. And now that I'm over my brain fart, that was New Germany requested that one. How about that? Just remember this one. Dinner was served for three at Dracula's house by the sea. The hors d'oeuvres were fine, but I choked on my wine when I found out the main course was me. For the main course, it was batwing confetti and the veins from a mummy named Betty. I first frowned upon it, but with ketchup on it, it tasted very much like spaghetti. And don't forget, the knives go on the right with the pitchforks. There was a waitress named Perkins who was so very fond of small gherkins that while serving tea she ate 43, which pickled her internal workings. Believe it or not, I memorized that from high school. That's a long time ago. No matter what I do, I can't get it out of my head, man. Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Well, I just had to hear that one again, but I had to turn it up a little bit. It was a little too weak for me, man. Yeah. Okay, that's enough of the silly stuff. Let's get down to business here and go back to our pessimist guide to history for some real scary stories. Let's go back to 1358. Jacquerie revolt in France. In France, the epithet Jacques Bonhomme, however it's pronounced, was an insulting name used by the nobility to refer to the peasant class. That's us. The Jacquerie, that's how they referred to the poor people. Resentment against the aristocracy, we've got one here in this country too. And the hardships of the Hundred Years' War produced disastrous results in northern France when noblemen tried to impose a new tax on the Jacquerie, the peasant class. Suddenly in Maine, the Jaguari, the peasant class, rose in a bloody revolt. Well, good for them. Armed with wooden staves, knives, the mobs of peasants wantonly attacked noblemen and their families, vowing to exterminate the entire aristocracy. Rebels committed horrible atrocities. Well, probably not any worse than had been performed on them. A knight was tied to a stake and forced to watch his wife and daughter while they were raped repeatedly and then cruelly tortured and killed. Well, that's what happens when there's payback time. Anything's liable to happen. Another knight was tied to a spit and roasted before the eyes of his wife and children, who were then offered the flesh to eat. Many of the noblemen fled to safety with their families, while rampaging peasants looted and burned castles and towns left behind. It was not long before the nobility responded with equally cruel atrocities, as if they hadn't committed atrocities before. Rebel peasants were slaughtered and hung from trees, lured into parleys with noblemen only to be captured and decapitated. In the town of Meaux, raiding peasants were trapped in the marketplace and slaughtered en masse by horsemen with lances, who then flung the bodies into the River Main. It is said that 7,000 peasants died in the clash alone. The revolt ended in June, less than a month after it began. Not only the peasants are revolting, it seems. Well, when the peasants revolt, there's always a good reason for it, because peasants are more like sheep most of the time, like the white people in this country. They'll put up with about anything, you know, as long as they don't lose their materialism. But these things always come to an end, and the peasants, the poor people, rise up and do nasty things to the people who've done nasty things to them and deprived them over the years. So peasants don't normally just rise up for nothing. They've been oppressed for a long time by the ruling class. That's my position. Okay, let's go up to 1381 A.D. Wat Tyler's Bloody Rebellion. Local uprising is against an unpopular poll tax coupled with a restrictive wage law and other grievance, sort of like minimum wage, you know. Finally kindled a two-month rebellion by peasants in early May that threatened to overthrow the English kingdom. A ragtag army of 60,000 to 100,000 peasants gathered under the loose leadership of Wat Tyler, Jack Straw, and John Ball and marched on London. Refused an audience with the king, some 30,000 of the angry peasants entered London, where they helped themselves to food and drink and then began to riot. 32 of them died drunk in the Duke of Lancer's wine cellar when the house burned down on top of them. Hordes of other angry, drunken peasants dragged foreigners into the street and robbed and beheaded them. Another mocking, drunken mob paraded through the streets with the heads of the Archbishops of Canterbury and four others. In a frenzied moment elsewhere, the arms and legs were cut off of noblemen, his body then literally torn to pieces. Wat Tyler was treacherously killed while negotiating with the king, and not long after, authorities gained the initiative. They were more methodical, but no less brutal than the rebels, executing some 1,500 peasants without trial to finally break the revolt. More goodwill towards men. And those of you out there who don't think there's a class struggle, and there's always a class struggle. The Republicans always get all upset when you say things like this, because, oh, you're causing class warfare, class hate, class envy. Believe me, the wealthy classes always use it against the poor peasants and so forth. They were virtual slaves. They called them peasants and things like that, but they were slaves, white people of Europe in most cases. unless you could get away far enough out in the woods where they didn't bother you. So the idea that, you see, right now 2 or 3% of the people in the country control almost all the money. That's very near a boiling point to where people rise up and start doing things. And then when they do these wild, horrible things, supposedly horrible, it's simply payback. And nature provides for payback. That's right. So anyhow, you tell all those neocon friends of yours that as long as they keep trying to sap up all the wealth and center it into just 2 or 3% of the people, sooner or later, we're coming for you, baby. We're coming for you. Well, I'm not sure how they're going to handle this one, but this is 1402, the rise of the black slave trade. In 1402, Juan de Betancourt became the first European to settle in the Canary Islands, located off the coast of Northwest Africa. Betancourt brought with him good intentions and the fruits of European culture. He worked for several years to build churches and introduce Christianity to the natives. Oh boy, that's all they needed. But at the same time, he made slaves of several of the islanders for his own personal use. The European rediscovery of the Canary Islands, ironically known to the ancients as the Fortunate Islands, heralded the beginning of the black slave trade and what became a centuries-long tragedy. Now remember, there was white slavery long before the black slavery. And they usually didn't call them slaves, but they called them peasants or whatever. So when blacks tell you, moan and groan about being enslaved, say, what about us white people that were enslaved a hell of a lot longer than you've been? Slavery was not a new idea and had been widely practiced in ancient times. It had largely been eliminated in Europe, thanks to the influence of the church. Well, first the church put them into slavery, and then it got them out. Now, however, the Europeans established a modern form of slavery in which millions of African blacks were enslaved and condemned to live lives of misery and death, which I condemn myself. Between 1418 and 1434, Portugal's Prince Henry commissioned many voyages of discovery along Africa's coast in order to discover new lands and bring back information about coastal Africa. During one expedition to the Canary Islands, a number of natives were seized and brought to Portugal as slaves. And, you know, and that's how Portugal inherited race mixing. You see, you start out, the rich think they're going to make a good deal, and you end up screwing up your own race. But they don't care as long as they can hide away in their castles and count their money. And in 1442, Henry directed that several captured Moors be exchanged in their country for black slaves to be transported to Portugal. Now remember, the Moors were like a mixed race people, and a lot of them were even white. So it began. Soon a flourishing trade in black slaves developed, first between Africa and Europe, and then between Africa and the colonies in the Americas. Most of the slaves were taken from a narrow band of West Africa between Senegal and southern Angola. By 1700, the demands for slaves to work the plantations of South, Central, and North America was enormous, and the slave traders carried gold, cloth, and rum to barter with African chiefs who willingly rounded up and traded away their own countrymen. The captured men and women were chained together and forced to walk as far as 900 miles to the coast. One trader wrote of the slaves' despair at having to leave their countries. See, blacks didn't want to come over here. Blacks didn't want to leave Africa, you see. I mean, we can only blame ourselves, and of course we can't all blame the Jews. I know there's a certain bunch of out there that want to blame that all on the Jews too, but believe me, there was just as many and a lot more white people involved in the slave trade than Jews. It's funny how a lot of the right-wing racists try to sidestep something like that and make it sound like it was all the Jews doing all this stuff, bringing these blacks to America. Remember, it was the kings of these countries and the governments of these countries that promoted slavery. King of England and all of them. So they were all into it and took a lot, took their armies, took all their preachers and their priests and everything else to enforce slavery. So it's a hell of a lot more than just Jews. They often leaped out of the canoes, boat, and ship into the sea and kept underwater till they were drowned to avoid being taken. The voyages of the slave ships across the Atlantic were quite literally deadly. Hundreds of slaves were forced to lie together in wretched confined spaces in the lower decks of the ships, with such poor sanitation that their quarters quickly became overwhelmingly foul-smelling. I want you to remember something. Most people, most white people, are not racist. They simply find that blacks in certain situations irritate them and like that. But they're not really racist, because a true white racist is a separatist. He does not want them living across the street. He does not want them living across town. He does not want them living in the same geographical area at all, and not even in the same country. We are separatists. I'm a separatist. I look at most of the white people I run into as, no matter what they say on the side to me or tell a nigger joke or whatever, they're not really racist, because they will drink with blacks, they will socialize with blacks, they will voluntarily work with blacks, and it's always this, well, this black is a good one. Well, we're not interested in whether they're good or bad. That has nothing to do with it. The black race should obviously have total hatred for the white race. They have every reason in the world, and I don't blame them, considering what happened in the slavery situation. And it's almost subconsciously, they must, if they're true black men, hate the white race. That's why Khalid Muhammad, I didn't have any problem with Khalid Muhammad at all when he said that very bad, nasty things, supposedly, against white people, because that's the way they should feel. So, I'm sorry, boys and girls, there's only one thing you can be, and that's a racial separatist. That means that you want to stay totally away from the black race. Now, obviously, in the society we live in today, it's impossible to be totally separated from blacks, especially with the workforce and all that kind of stuff. But you can do everything possible and not encourage them at all, and even say something about race mixing to people, that you're totally against it and it's bad and all that kind of stuff. But most white people go along to get along. And that's not white racism. That's not white separatism. Let's get back to the slavery situation here. Disease was a constant problem, sometimes even striking the ship's crew as well as their shackled cargo. Though these conditions were bad enough, storms during the voyage often proved fatal for many of the slaves, with the hatches battened down for days on end. The misery of those confined below was more than they could survive. Now, true white separatists would not agree to that kind of treatment of even an animal, another animal. But there are many people today running around saying how they really love the black race, that probably their own ancestors would be into that kind of stuff. But they'll lie and claim they wouldn't be. There were dangers during calm weather, too. When the slave ships were becalmed, the voyage took longer, making food and water scarce. One slave ship captain cited a water shortage as sufficient reason for throwing 54 ailing slaves overboard during a long voyage. Now, is that the kind of white racist you are? I'm not. Although the slave trade was finally outlawed by the British in 1807, huge profits were still to be made, and trafficking in black slaves continued for years afterward. When the slave traders sighted an anti-slavery patrol, they'd cruelly drown their entire human cargo to avoid being caught. And that's either white Christian captains or Jew captains. And I'll venture to say most of the time they were white Christian captains. By the time the slave trade finally ended in the 19th century, some 20 million Africans had been forcibly taken from their homelands and sold into slavery. Possibly as many as half of them died en route, overcome by the misery and hardships they encountered. A prime example of man's inhumanity to man. Well, that's true. And I accept that. And I accept the fact that the black race should hate the white race. And the white race should not want to be mingled with a lower race of people. The black race is something that we shouldn't have mixed with at all, ever. It's a black plague. But it was all the rich classes that wanted slavery to make a lot of money. And they still do. Now they don't care who they enslave. Slave Chinamen, they enslaved the Chinamen nearly as badly as they did the blacks. And, of course, whites, too. And if you think that these guys in power give one shit about the white working class, you're crazy. They do not care. They care more about a servile nigger than a proud white man any day. And that's one of the reasons why the very rich corporates like to hire more blacks, if they've got enough brains to do the job. The one problem the rich have is that there's just so many blacks that got enough brains to do anything. And so they're on the heels of a dilemma there. If they want to really get something done, they can't kill all off the white people, but they can keep white people in a state of servitude using things like, look what you did to these black people back in that time way back there. Well, it wasn't the working class. In fact, the border states in the South, in the northern part of the Confederacy, they didn't want any part of the war, because they were mostly yeoman farmers with small farms. And they, at most, maybe had one or two slaves. And probably they were treated pretty well, because it wouldn't be too hard for one or two slaves to overcome a landowner and his wife or maybe their kids and kill them. So, I don't think there was much of that going on. So anyhow, it's always the idle rich. And then the same rich that are running around today slough it all off on the white working classes being dumb, hillbilly, stupid, racist bastards. But we're not. We love the Negroes. That's why I don't get upset when the black militants go to work on the rich class. If I was a black militant, all along I've been a black, a white separatist. And that's why I've gotten along with black separatists, because I agree with most of what they've said that's been done to them and what the lying people at the top keep lying about what happened. But you see, when the whites in the South go crazy over that rebel flag, which it stood for the plantations and all that, don't let them kid you. When they stand up and support that, they're supporting these oligarchs that enslaved everybody. They didn't call it slavery among the whites, but they were enslaved. It was the white peasants of the South, and then they were stupid enough to go along and fight the goddamn war for the rich planters class. So you can see why the blacks a lot of the blacks, ones that understand, some of them just react, but there's plenty of black separatists out there. Of course they get pissed off. You got that flag that was the flag of the rich planters that subjugated us for 100 years, 200 years. And you expect us not to get pissed off? Well, I understand all this. I can go on a black radio show and get along fine, as long as they understand my wish is total separation. And then they can do what they want. They can have their own police, their own governments, their own towns, whatever they want. But we want to be separate. And that's why I get treated, or have been treated quite well, on black radio shows. Because there's a hell of a lot of blacks understand that I understand that I'm not necessarily the enemy of the black race. We just want separation. And when you're talking to young people, try to explain this to them. Because they need to know that. Because the propaganda is terrible against white separatists. As, oh, we just want to put them back in chains and all that bullshit. No, we don't want plantations. I can think of nothing worse than having slaves. I can't even think of having a housekeeper that's black. In fact, I can't even think of having a housekeeper, period. I come from the white working class, and we do our own work. We sweep our own floors. We clean our own toilets. We don't need slaves or housekeepers or anything else. But do these other so-called white racial leaders like Duke and people like that explain it when they get on TV? No, they don't, because they support the ruling class. They want to be part of the ruling class. They can't stand it because they're not part of the ruling class. So they're not going to condemn the crimes of the rich because they want to become those people. And it's been that way ever since I've been involved in this thing. There's only a handful of people who preach what I preach. Total racial separation in support of the white working class. And that's why we haven't gotten too far, because there's not enough of us doing that. That's why I hope that maybe this radio program will help promote that kind of thinking. Because without that kind of thinking, everybody's going to hate us. Look what they've done with the Pentagon, what they've done to the Middle East. Now the whole goddamn throng of Muslims over there hate us, just like they did when the Crusaders went down there to pillage and kill in the so-called Holy Land. It was the insanity of that. The Crusaders were doing it all over again. And then we expect these people not to hate us? Shit. Last night I was watching a movie, very good movie, about the Arab guerrillas getting into England. And of course there's a whole lot of them living there now. And attempting to terrorize and plant bombs. And to the average white Englander and white American, it's terrible. It's horrible. Why is this horrible? And we got to get them and we got to kill them and all that. Well, we probably do, but why are they doing it? I mean, why are they doing it? They didn't do it 50 years ago. They didn't do it really 100 years ago. Why are they doing it now? Well, you know why. Now, there's one Arab cleric here, and I know I'll get accused of being a Muslim lover now, but I don't care because I'm not, but I'm not any kind of religious lover of Christianity, Judaism, or Muslim. I pox upon all of them. But there was a cleric in the movie. He was talking to this young Arab Palestinian or something. I don't know what exactly he was. But he was a moderate, like most of these guys. They go to England, they get themselves a white girlfriend, and live happily ever after. But he was explaining the problem with this young guy, trying to get him to think about his blood, thinking about what people should think about. And this is a little speech he gave the guy. I'm going to play it for you.
Who occupy our lands, who come at us with smiles, today cause ours, and turn us against each other. in this so-called democracy, if you speak up about Muslims being slaughtered, you're an extremist. Huh? Yes? But if you are passive, silent, easy to control, you're a good Muslim. Yes? Just like a dog. They throw you a bone. But keep you on a leash. You know the type of Muslim I'm talking about. He's so ashamed of who he is. He gives himself a Western name. He tries to think and feel like his Western master. Live like him. Be him. You say to him, let's stop the murder of Muslims. And he would say, you ignorant foreigner. You want me to jeopardize my nice life in my country. This is the fool who wears an England football shirt and says, we won the match. And the man next to him, in the same shirt, calls him a paki. A nigger. Ask yourself, who are you? Really?
Now, the star of the movie was a man who'd fought in the Middle East and lost buddies over there and like that, and he was out to kill every Muslim he could, and he didn't see any hypocrisy whatsoever in what was going on. Here, Americans are saying, we love the Muslims, but we're bombing the shit out of them all 24 hours a day. And so one of them gets over here, like, if the position was reversed, I would be feeling exactly the same way. And so if we're going to be white racists, we can't be hypocrites. We've got to understand the situation, understand why we have the problems, how to get rid of the problems, and who is the main problem behind all this. And usually it's not the colored at all. That doesn't mean we want to marry them and sleep with them and all that kind of stuff, but it means that they don't start it, usually. I hope you get that through your head. And when my buddy called me and said they hit the World Trade Center, you know what my response to him was? The chickens have come home to roost. And that's what I said. And that's what I believed, because the military-industrial complex had been making deals with the very rich, the corporations too, making deals with the very rich, stealing their oil. That doesn't get spread around. That money doesn't get spread around hardly at all. It's just a small group of people at the top. And then because of that, there's uprisings in our corporate bodyguards, the U.S. military goes in, occupies the damn country, and then the people start using guerrilla warfare, just like they always do. And the crazy part about it is the ruling class allows them to immigrate into our countries. I mean, if you're really going to keep that problem out, you would not let them in. It's like the ruling class has a death wish or something. I don't know quite what it is, but it's insanity, I'll tell you that. And millions of people suffer because of those bastards. Well, I lost my place. I lost my place. This is going to be a chopped up show here. I don't know what happened. But anyhow, when they come over here and we let them in, and then they decide to blow up something, and then we go, whoa, why would they do that? We love everybody. America loves everybody. Land of the free. Look how many of them we let in here. Well, many of them are quite wealthy, too. Don't forget that. But many of them are not. And then if they do something wild, which I'm amazed, I've been amazed ever since 9/11, that there was no real guerrilla warfare going on. Almost all of it has been created by the FBI to make it look like there's a war going on, to drain the taxpayers of more money for all these crazy-ass programs. So they chase a few Muslims around the country and talk them into stuff, you know, like they do our people, too. They get involved with some stuff, and then they put them in prison and say, "Aren't we wonderful? We stopped those Muslims." And, you know, when the World Trade Center was taken out, I got a call from one of my friends, and he woke me up, or no, he didn't wake me up, but said, "Look, the World Trade Center's been knocked down." I said, "Wow, that's something else." He said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, the chickens have come home to roost." And if it had been a totally an Arab Muslim thing, well, what can I say? We've been bombing them by the hundreds of thousands and killing them and setting them up and lying about them and everything else. And so I wasn't surprised at all if it was all the Muslims or part of the Muslims or just a couple of the Muslims. So, or whether it was doctored by our arch criminal, George Bush Jr. and the Cheney Bunch. By the way, what happened to those some of those people? Now, we do hear from Cheney once in a while, and we do hear from Bush once in a while, but there was the Secretary of Defense and people like that. I forget their names, but they just disappeared. Wolfowitz and those guys, where did they go? When this stuff happens, these guys just disappear. You know, once the present regime is out of the way, they're gone. I mean, you know, you'd think the press would be following them around a little bit and interviewing them and seeing what they're up to and investigating them. But no, they're just gone. So white Americans are so simplistic about things. They say, "Oh, I haven't done anything to anybody. Why would they hate me? Why would they hate you?" Well, it's the government that represents you. It's the federal criminal system that represents you, that does all the crime, and you don't pay attention. You just go to the movies or go to the bar, what the hell? If you don't demonstrate against the wars and in occupation, you just sit on your ass. So when the Muslims come back and whack you, well, you should understand why they whack you. But again, it's follow the money. Always follow the money. People who want things to happen, even bad things, just follow the money and you'll find out. It's Friday, and I want to put a little, if you want to know who the problem is and who's behind everything, just here again, look for the City of London, banking, Federal Reserve, banking, profits from the military-industrial complex, and all that stuff. These guys that pauperized a hell of a lot of people in the country with the back in 2007, 2008, that now are sitting on billions of dollars. Well, you want an enemy, that's your enemy. It's not some guy sitting in a hut in the middle of the desert over in North Africa. It wasn't a little guy sitting in his bamboo hut in Vietnam either. And it wasn't the little guy sitting in his little Korean hut. Pardon me. Back in the Korean War. It never is. They train you to kill the little people. Never train you to kill the really important people. Even the important people, enemies. Because they're afraid if you start doing that, then the other side will come back and kill them. Yeah.
As a report, I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Rowan Bosworth Davies. He's a former Met detective dealing with financial crimes. Rowan, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
It's great to see you again, Max.
All righty. Let's get right into it. Now, your latest blog post is titled, "J'accuse George Osborne." Now, what are you accusing the Chancellor of the Exchequer?
Well, it's a catchy title, right? But my biggest beef with him is that he is just bending over backwards to give the white boys and the spivs in the city just everything they want in terms of making life very easy for them to accept dirty money and foreign money coming in from sources which they should otherwise be doing a lot more to identify. And in so doing, he is actually facilitating an awful lot of financial crime. Now, I'm not saying that he's doing this maliciously. I don't believe he is. I believe he's doing it because he just doesn't know any better, because he's committed to this idea of, you know, the banks and the financial sector are going to lead, the sort of, you know, the way forward. But the problem is we've still got rules and regulations that say what banks have to do before they can accept new clients and new money. And those regulations are just being discarded willy-nilly and thrown out of the window in the name of doing away with red tape. It's actually causing more problems than it's solving. I mean, just last week we had the Director General of the National Crimes Authority is on the record saying that London is awash, billions and billions of foreign criminal money.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit. You're saying billions and billions of foreign money pouring in at the same time that the government, and Osborne in particular, is pursuing these austerity measures, claiming poverty. So apparently, if you're not a spiv, then you live in a Britain that's going bankrupt and you need to have your benefits cut. But if you are a spiv, you're swimming in billions of cash coming in every single day, and everything you touch goes up in value like a stock, a bond, or a property?
Well, I mean, that's the point that I'm trying to – that's the irony I'm trying to expose, is that the fact that it seems that we have one law for the vast number of ordinary people, just the ordinary man and woman in the street who've got to put up with all this austerity. But at the same time, if you're working in the square mile, the laws will just be dispensed with in order to enable it, to make it easier for you to accept the money that's coming in from God knows where, because they don't know where it's coming from. I mean, today in the paper, there's a story, in the Times this morning, there's a story about the amount of money that Franco sequestered, stole out of the Spanish state,
mm-hmm.
and which he's bequeathed to his family. I mean, they're still enjoying it. But this kind of money from heads of state and foreign dictators that is simply finding a very safe home, thank you very much, here in the City of London. And I'm saying that there's just a sheer degree of hypocrisy here.
All right. Now, The Guardian, a newspaper headline from July reads, foreign criminals use London housing market to launder billions of pounds. This was for a National Crime Agency spokesman. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that works?
Well, we have, as your viewers will know, we've got a major housing or property building boom certainly in London, but at the very, very high end of the market.
Okay, is housing a problem because there's a shortage of housing, or is housing a problem because the prices have gone out of reach for most people due to this influx of corrupt money into the country?
Well, no. I mean, we need a lot more affordable housing.
So
than
what's
we've already...
contributing to the unaffordability of housing more? Shortage of housing or price appreciation due to influx of ill-gotten foreign...
Because, look, we've got people who are prepared to pay ludicrous prices...
Who are those people?
Foreigners.
Right. So that's what I'm saying.
Chinese, Malaysians, people from the Middle East.
And there's a strong undercurrent to suggest that this is not money that has been adequately reviewed in terms of its possible association with criminal behavior.
Vast amounts of it have not been subjected to proper due diligence procedures. It's come into the bank without the proper questions being asked. I mean, you had to.
Okay, so once again, if the government says, oh, the answer to our housing shortage is we're going to build 60,000, 80,000 new units, but on an economic apple to apple comparison, the greatest thing Osborne could do to make housing more affordable is to stop this influx of foreign laundered money.
Well, what he could do is make the amount of building that's going on much more equitable. I mean, there's no reason why foreigners can't buy property in this country. But the problem with it is that if you're building, if you're a builder and you're building property and you can build it knowing that some secret buyer, you going through an offshore company, will pay you an arm and a leg to buy a property, which he may never even ever live in. These buildings, they call them dark buildings because there are never any lights on. This is just money, foreign money, standing still in London, waiting while the possessor of that, I don't use the word owner, the possessor of that money decides what to do with it. But it's just yet another way of finding ways of laundering money, of disguising money and keeping it out of the hands of the law enforcement authorities.
Okay, I just want to be clear that whenever David Cameron stands up in the House of Commons and talks about the need to build more housing to stem the housing shortage, he's misspeaking, because the clear way to solve the housing crisis in a more equitable fashion would be to stop the inflow of laundered money. But let's move on. So in the U.S., you know, Ben Bernanke, the former head of the central bank there, he's got a new book, and in the book, he says, you know what, looking back over the crisis, going, you know, 2008 and all the bailouts and all the TARP money, you know, a lot of bankers should have gone to jail like they did over in Iceland. So is there a statute of limitations here in the UK? Is it too late?
Well, the trouble is we haven't even started yet. That's the problem. There are a lot of bankers who have committed criminal offences within the financial sector area. But the problem is, we've actually very recently started to make it easier for them to get away with their wrongdoing. Because you probably remember a couple of years ago, there was a big hoo-ha, and one of the House of Commons select committees looked into banking culture, a wonderful phrase. They looked into banking culture. I remember the chairman was constantly saying, listening to these horror stories that were coming out, and he kept saying, why has nobody gone to prison? And so what happened was the government then said, right, we'll pass a new law that will make it so much harder for deviant bankers to get away with their wrongdoing. And one of the important elements of that was that where banks showed signs of collapsing, the law said that the banker himself will be called upon to demonstrate what he knew and what he knew about the state of his bank and what he knew and what the time was at the time and what did he do about it. Now, that would be a very sensible piece of legislation in order to put the focus on the banker to say, well, what did you do to prevent your bank collapse? I mean, imagine they'd done that to Fred Goodwin at RBS. And then just recently, like last week, I read in the Times that because of lobbying from the BBA and from the banking sector, they've now done away with that. Mm. Very quietly, they pushed that into the long grass. So that now means that this law, this great law they trumpeted, that said that this was going to bring the bankers to account, it's null and void.
Well, this has been the history of the past 25, 30 years. And going back to the S&L crisis in the United States,
yeah.
When they were caught, bankers were caught breaking the law, a lot of them went to jail, and the response was to change the law. So then when the 2008 crisis came along, they did the exact same thing that they did during the previous crisis, but it was no longer illegal. So they would say, well, it's not illegal to do what we did. Yeah, because they changed the law to make what used to be illegal just a few years before legal. And what you're describing here is same thing in the UK. So when laws are broken, the response is don't prosecute the bankers, change the law. In Iceland, they said, no, we're going to stick with the law, and therefore you're going to jail. So that's a cultural shift. I mean, certainly there's a different approach. Now, I want to kind of skip gears here for a second. So it has emerged that in the EU, Commission knew about the Volkswagen emissions fraud back in 2013, but as Bernanke did nothing to stop the banking fraud, so the EU commissioners did nothing to expose or punish this protected elite class of manufacturers. So here's kind of like removing different industries. In other words, if you allow bankers to commit fraud with impunity, you know, why shouldn't Volkswagen commit fraud? It's a similar type of fraud. They're using algorithms. They're using computer technology to commit massive fraud. And they're simply saying, oh, well, you know, well, they're getting away with it, essentially. Do you see that epidemic of fraud and criminal behavior spreading because of the lack of will of the politicians to prosecute?
I see it as symptomatic of a cultural and an ethical change within a wide variety of business sectors. However, I sense that the makers of VW cars are not going to get the same level of protection that the bankers get. And I can actually spell that out for you. I mean, I think certainly in America, I think executives of a certain car company may very well find themselves doing jail time. And that's what I genuinely think. But I don't know if I've ever told you this story before, but I mean, some years ago, I was invited to do a series of lectures on financial crime and money laundering law, and I was invited to this event. And in the evening, there was a dinner, and I sat at the table, and I was sat next to a senior executive from one of the big five banks. And he said to me, oh, Mr. Bosworth, he said, I listened very carefully to what you say. And he said, I'm fascinated by your stories and all the rest of it. He said, but I can assure you in one area, he said, you are completely wrong. He said, I can assure you, nobody of my class, and these were his words, I've never forgotten them, nobody of my class will ever go to prison in this country for financial crime. He said, we are a protected species.
Mm.
And that was his phrase. And you know what? You talk to a lot of senior bankers over the river there about that. And that is how they feel. They feel, that genuinely feel, they're protected.
Yeah, well, clearly they are a protected species. And there is no attempt to rein in this rampant criminality because the economy itself relies on the dividends paid out from crime. So this is the biggest component of this economy would be fraud. But Roland, we got to cut it off there. Thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
So you heard the admission right there from some of the biggest bankers in England, which is the same way over here. We are a protected class, and no person high up in that kind of a game is ever going to go to jail for financial crimes against the people. So what have I been telling you? Instead of occupying Iraq and Syria and all that kind of stuff, we should be like occupying the banks, occupying those mahogany lined halls and offices on Wall Street. And that's why I supported the Occupy struggle, even though a lot of those people don't know exactly what they're doing. So they're certainly not racist, and they're extremely so-called left and progressive, but if they're right on the money, that's part of the big part of the problem, and it can never be solved without going after the people that are holding the money illegally. So anyhow, that's it for today. I hope you have a good spook day or spook night. It's interesting how the Christians, millions of Christians, go crazy celebrating a pagan holiday. I think we should collect a buck a head from all of them for the pagans, for the heathens. How about that? See you Monday, 14:05. And this show will be late today, because I had editing problems, and I'm going to have Webmaster edit it before it goes out. So you're going to have to wait a while this evening to get the show. And I put this announcement at the wrong end of the show. Really?